And now on RT Radio 1, time for tonight's Arena Olympiad, where Sean Rocks and Kay Sheehy bring you interviews with musician Joaquin Cooter, American singer-songwriter Roseanne Cash, British actor Jared Harris, and American country singer-songwriter John Carter Cash.
You're listening to Arena's Olympiad, the best of Irish radio arts, with me, Kay Sheehy. Cooter first became interested in the drums at the tender age of 5, when he was inspired by one of the greatest percussion session musicians of the 1970s, Jim Keltner. At the time, Jim was recording and touring drummer with, amongst others, Joaquin's father, the legendary Ry Cooter. And hanging around with some of the greatest musicians of the era stood the young Joaquin in good stead. Having played on the Buena Vista Social Club with his father and the cream of Cuban musicians, Joaquin went on to carve a successful music career for himself, playing with musical luminaries like Johnny Cash and John Lee Hooker. Right now, he's in the Galway studio with a couple of his musicians, Raina Gellert on fiddle and Mark Fain on bass. Joaquin, you're very welcome to Arena.
Thank you so much, Kay, for having us.
Now, this is your over-the-road Irish tour, where you're touring the music from your last album, which is called Over the Road I'm Bound, the songs of Uncle Dave Mason. And that was released in 2020. Who is Uncle Dave Mason?
Well, he was born in the late 1800s in Nashville, Tennessee. And he took a lot of music from his childhood that he heard as people came through town. Medicine show, folk, minstrel music, blues. His parents owned a hotel. And so he picked up a lot of this music. And then later in his life, in his 50s, he became famous by repopularizing that music for a whole new audience that didn't know it because it's all pre-recorded. And had he not done this, a lot of this music would have just been lost to time. And he's considered the first star of the Grand Ole Opry.
So let's listen to some of that music. This is Come Along, Buddy.
Found you in the end. my buddy, don't you wanna go? Bottles, blue and green, laid out by your TV screen. I've been hearing your voice inside each one. I'm wondering what it means. Getting happy, don't you know now? Come along, buddy, don't you wanna go now? Come along, buddy, don't you wanna go now? Getting happy, don't you know now? Come along, buddy, don't you wanna go now? Getting happy, don't you know now? Come along, buddy, don't you wanna go now?
Come along, buddy, there from Joachim Cooder. And with him is Raina Gellert and Mark Fain. Mark Fain's on bass and Raina Gellert is on fiddle. And Joachim, you're playing an imbira. What is an imbira? That wonderful, exotic sounding instrument we heard there.
Oh, thank you. Well, if you picture like a small African thumb piano or a kalimba, this is this grand electric version of it that I keep on my lap, and I can put it through some effects, like you heard that kind of long reverb tail and sometimes some distortion, and it's not chromatic like a piano. It goes up across the board in fifths, so it's very modal and can be very Celtic or African. It can go into these different modes pretty easily.
And it's like you're flicking tiny little switches or tiny little pieces of metal.
Yeah, they're little tines. And in fact, when he first started making these, he would go along the street behind street sweepers. And, you know, like those big metal things would spin and clean the street. And
yes,
the little things would fly off and he would collect those. And then that's how he first started building these instruments when he, you know, was just starting out. And then now it's very refined and pretty looking, but it was pretty rugged at one point.
I was looking at the track list of the Buena Vista Social Club again today, and I saw that your dad plays an imbira on some of the tracks. Is it very different to what you're playing?
That's probably the first one that we got. It was this big acoustic version, and that was the only one he was making. His name is Bill Wesley, and he lives in San Diego, which is like 3 hours south of where I live in LA. And then years later, I found out he'd started making these big electric ones, and I got very excited.
What was his aim when the two of you arrived in Havana?
Well, the goal was something actually completely different, which was these West African musicians were supposed to arrive. And then the concept of the record was to explore the intersection, I guess, of West African and Cuban music and see what comes of it. But when we got to the studio on that first day, we heard that the West Africans never got their visas. And so we had to, on the spot, figure out what to do with all that. You know, we were there for two weeks, one way or another. And so he said, let's see if there's any, you know, pre-revolutionary musicians from the 40s and 50s still around, and let's see if we can get them down. And then that's, you know, Ibrahim Ferrer walked out of history. He'd been, you know, shining shoes, hadn't been playing music. And so the whole thing that happened was this, you know, grand accident.
And was it as magical being there as we experienced it later in both the album and the film?
It was very magical. When you do these things, you show up and you hope for the best, and you never know what to expect. nobody in the room at that time thought, and one day soon this will be the great Buena Vista Social Club. It's not, you don't think like that. You're just in this room with the musicians and listening to each other and trying not to step on any toes.
Another person you met with your dad was Sinead O'Connor in New York. And you have a good memory of work you did with her.
Well, yeah, I was pretty, that was for the Chieftains record, The Long Black Veil. And they did that song together, She Moves Through the Fair, which already was a big favorite of mine. And so when I got to stand in the room and watch the two of them do that song together, it was pretty, I mean, just thinking about it now, especially, is very, it sends chills down my spine.
You're going to introduce us to another track now. This is called Morning Blues.
Yeah, this is the first, this is the one that I learned of Uncle Dave's when I was really little, because my dad would play it on the banjo, and then recently started playing it again for my kids. So it's a sort of multi-generational banjo tune, now played on the imbira. Morning Blues.
And I've been in love, used to fly high like a turtle dove. Had the blues many a time, just a woman on a poor man's mind. I got the morning blues, oh so bad. I said, honey, come and kiss me, it's the worst I ever had. Ashes to ashes, dust to dust, find me a woman that a man can trust. A dime's worth the grease and a nickel worth the lard, I would buy more, but the times are so hard. I got the morning blues, oh so bad. I said, honey, come and kiss me, it's the worst I ever had. Working so hard, I got a woman in the rich folks' yard. Well, she brings me meat and she brings me pie, bring me some of everything the rich folks buy. I got the morning blues, oh so bad. I said, honey, come and kiss me, it's the worst I ever had. I said, honey, come and kiss me, it's the worst I ever had. I said, honey, come and kiss me, it's the worst I ever had.
Uncle Dave Mason's Morning Blues there, sung by Joaquim Cooder as he played the imbira. And Raina Gellert was on fiddle and Mark Fain was on bass.
American singer-songwriter and author Roseanne Cash is the eldest daughter of country musician Johnny Cash and his first wife Vivian Cash. Beginning her own musical career in the late 1970s, Roseanne has received 16 Grammy nominations and has had 4 wins. Delighted to be joined on the line by Roseanne Cash this evening, who's speaking to us from New York.
Hello, it's nice to speak to you.
One of the things, of course, that I think your father, Johnny Cash, has said this, and you have said it too, when you go on stage, you do ask yourself questions, or you put the questions out there on the stage as you perform. Talk to me a little bit about that emotional journey, because there must be healing in that, to perform maybe emotionally difficult material or that touches you in an emotional way.
And, you know, it depends on the day, the night, the audience, the venue, how tired you are, what you need, what you're taking to the stage. It's really, I mean, I saw my dad do this where he took the best parts of himself to the spotlight. And there was, between him and the audience, this chemical exchange of energy. There was true depth of feeling and healing. And I have found that in my own life as well. And it's something about the community with the audience. It's not just about going to be seen and heard. It's about that sense of community and exchange. And, you know, Bob Dylan said a great thing. He said, the audience doesn't come to feel your feelings. They come to feel their own feelings. Mm. So, you know, if you serve as a spark for that, that's a great service.
And I guess, but there is ultimately that communication between audience and performer, which is what makes live music so special. It's only for the people who are there in the hall on that particular night at that particular moment.
That's right. I mean, of course, bits and pieces get up to YouTube, but there's nothing like being, it's like a monk sand painting that's kind of destroyed once it's over. It was those 2 hours, that was it. And that's part of the great beauty of it.
I can only imagine what the emotional temperature can have been like in 2003 when you recorded September When It Comes with your father. And this is a song written for the two of you by your husband. I mean, that's a song that is incredibly potent in terms of familial relationships.
Well, John wrote the music. My husband wrote the music. I had written the lyrics and he found them laying around. I'm not very organized sometimes. And he picked them up and he said, "What's this?" And I said, "It's some lyrics I wrote." And he wrote the music to it, and this beautiful, mournful melody. And it was called September When It Comes, as you said. And then my dad ended up dying in September. And Vice President Al Gore spoke at my dad's memorial, and he said, "It's September." And, you know, we were all in tears. It was a beautiful moment.
Let's listen to a little bit of that duet between yourself and your father, Johnny Cash, September When It Comes.
There's a cross above the baby's bed, a savior in her dreams, but she was not delivered then, and the baby became me. There's a light inside a darkened room, a footstep on the stair, a door that I memories there. So when the shadows lengthen into an evening sun, well, first there's summer, then I'll let you in. September When It Comes.
Outside these walls, close my eyes and see and fall into the heart and arms of those who wait for me. I cannot move a mountain now. I can no longer run. I cannot be who I was then. In a way, I never was.
Watch the clouds go sailing. Watch the clock and sun. Oh, I watch myself depending on
September, when it comes. Shadows lengthen and burn away the past. They will fly me like an angel to a place where I can rest. When this begins,
I'll let you in
September,
when it comes.
I don't know about you, Roseanne. You're not in the same room as me. You're several thousand miles away in New York. But as I listened to those words that your father sings, and then, as we know, he was dead, you know, very soon afterwards. How is it for you, even at this remove, 20-something years later, to listen to that?
Well, I haven't listened to it in a long time, so I felt quite overwhelmed listening to it just then. And, you know, the words were very prescient. Yeah. Well, you know, I was just, Sean, I was going about my day packing up some boxes and things, and now you've taken me to a whole different place.
Sorry I did that to you. But all I can say to you is I felt, and, you know, I've never met you before. I don't think we've spoken before. Even just listening to it, knowing that you were on the other side of the headphones, the microphones in New York, I felt kind of I was part of something very private and very special. Growing up with your father as the man that he was and the wonderful singer that we all know and so many people, particularly in this country, love. What did that do for you in your music career? It must have been both a blessing and a difficulty.
Yeah, it was. It was a difficulty, particularly when I was younger. It's not that different from any young person who wants to separate from their parents and find their own path and find who they are. You know, my dad did cast a very large shadow, and I was going into the same field as him. So it was difficult. And as I got older, and got some time under my belt and some success under my belt and got better as a songwriter and performer, it's gotten easier. But at some point I realized what a gift my own legacy is and how ungracious it would be not to embrace it fully.
Yeah, I can only imagine what a wonderful moment that must have been when you did find the courage to embrace it fully, because I'm sure there was courage involved in that. And I know, wasn't there at one point you were debating whether you would use the name Cash at all? You decided, obviously, I'm speaking to Roseanne Cash, not Roseanne somebody else or something else. When you decided to use that family name, your father was delighted.
Yeah, in the very early stages of my career, I thought, well, how am I going to get away from this comparison and this shadow? And I thought, well, I'll just use my grandmother's maiden name, which was Rivers. And I thought about it for a while and then decided against it. My dad knew that I was considering that, and he kind of breathed a sigh of relief when I said, I'm going to use my own name.
Yeah, yeah. And not only that, you found a much better way of getting away from it, if that's the right term. 16 Grammy nominations and 4 wins of your own. kind of marks in the sand who you are, rather than, you know, the fact that you're that wonderful man's daughter in the midst of it all. You re-released your album, The Wheel, last year, which is a hugely important album in terms of yourself and your husband, John.
Yeah, what was interesting is we recorded that album in 1993. It's the first record John and I ever made together. We fell in love making the record, got married the next year and a half later. And I had a clause in my contract with Sony, who I was signed to at the time, that I would regain ownership of the master recording after 30 years. And that 30 years came due last year. And I felt so proud that I owned it again. I said, well, what should we do? Well, let's remaster it for modern sonic times and re-release it. And that's what we did.
And what a way to celebrate your 30th wedding anniversary, which must be in and around this time, is it?
We just celebrated 29, so yep, it's coming up next year.
Coming up next year. Well, listen, Roseanne, it has been an absolute privilege and pleasure to speak with you this evening. Sorry if I upset you later on. But,
No. It's the good kind of upset, yeah. You know. Though even painful memories are sweet. So thank you, Sean.
Thank you very much, Roseanne. And looking forward to hearing and seeing your gig when you get here in the coming weeks and months. Thanks very much, Roseanne.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
Recognised for his compelling performances in the acclaimed series such as Mad Men, Chernobyl, The Terror and The Crown, Jared Harris has consistently demonstrated his versatility as an actor. Son of the late Richard Harris and Elizabeth Reese Williams, he has forged his own path in the world of entertainment, picking up a Best Actor BAFTA along the way. His latest film, Reawakening, a psychological thriller that follows the story of a couple who have lived in an agonising limbo of grief and guilt for 10 years after their only child ran away from home. When she returns, now aged 24, tensions resurface, suspicions are raised, and Jared Harris stars alongside Juliet Stevenson and fellow The Crown alumna Erin Doherty. Delighted that Jared Harris is with me in studio this evening. It's a wonderful script. This was obviously something you saw when you read it. There was something in this script that caught your imagination and this character of John that you play.
Yes. Well, first of all, I just want to say thank you for mentioning my mum. You're the first person ever to do that in an intro. Bless you.
Important that they're both there.
Yeah. The script, this one, superficially is about a mystery. But underneath it, it's really about how the two main characters choose to handle grief and handle this event that's occurred to them. And they handle it in very, very different ways. Unusually, in these circumstances, when parents lose a child, they don't stay together. And they have managed to keep the marriage together. And in large part, by taking that very English way out of not talking about it. But you could tell that they're completely still gripped by it. And it's very cleverly indicated by the writer, because after you see them sitting down having that, we introduced the characters on that first intro, they sit down to watch a police procedural about the disappearance of a young girl. So it's still very much there in the kind of, it's almost a negative space of their relationship that they're too frightened to investigate, because they don't want to know the answer to how they managed to resolve it.
And Virginia Gilbert, we should say, because you're speaking so strongly about the writing, she is the writer, as she is the director of the film as well. A character appears then, the Erin Doherty character comes back, and here we go, after 10 years.
Yeah, I mean, basically is that this couple's daughter runs away from home when she's 14, and they hear nothing about her after that, and then they don't know what's happened to her. There's a big police, there's a manhunt for her, but she's not, there's no information about her. And 10 years later, there's a sort of reenactment of it to try and see if they could spark any memories. And then some months afterwards, a young woman shows up who's 24 years old, who looks very like she could, the way that this 14-year-old would be 10 years later, has all the right answers, or most of the right answers. And I guess, you know, and the mystery of the film is that the mother recognizes her right away, accepts her right away, but he doesn't.
Yeah.
And the paradox of that is that he's spent the entire 10 years looking for her, trying to find her.
Yeah. Let's have a listen to a clip which gives us a sense of that dynamic between the husband and wife, that John, this character has, this young woman has appeared into their lives. He's very dubious about it. And on the surface of it, Juliet Stevenson as Mary is a lot more accepting of the person's bona fides.
I know you want this more than anything. God knows I do too, but you must feel it. You must feel it isn't right.
Don't tell me what I feel. Don't. For 10 years, I've heard nothing but you have to stay positive. You have to believe. You have to give up hope. You have to find peace. For 10 years, I've been told what I have to feel, what I have to think. And I did what I was told. I had no choice. I had nothing to hold on to.
You hurt me.
That's Jared Harris and Juliet Stevenson.
Yeah,
she's
magnificent. Yeah.
You're not too bad yourself either. The pair of you, there is a lovely, that's in the film we're talking about this evening, Reawakening. There's an extraordinary scene that, and I don't want to go into the specifics of who's speaking even here, because I might give too much away by doing that. But there's an extraordinary scene in the film where you're sitting at a table, because he loves little toy trains, model trains. And so he's there kind of playing with this train or fixing this train. And there's a character telling him some vital information to the entire plot, standing right beside him. I timed it when I was watching it. The character's speech, the character who's speaks for maybe 3.5 to 4 minutes. The camera does not move off you for almost all of that. There's a little shot of the other character at the beginning and at the end of the speech. It's a phenomenal, brave moment to just let the camera sit and watch you reacting, which is, of course, what it's all about.
Listening is very, is a difficult, I don't want to call it a trick, it's a difficult aspect of screen acting to learn. And you can tell immediately. And for example, on Mad Men, I directed an episode in the last season, and I shadowed the season before. And John Hamm, if you watched his coverage and any scene he was in, he told a whole story. It didn't matter if he was not speaking or not. But he told his version of the story of the scene, and you could actually have just played it on what he was doing. The same with Elizabeth Moss. They were, and it, partly it was just innate talent, but also it was they were making choices constantly about what their character felt about what was happening in the scene and what they were hearing and what they were reacting to.
Did you learn a lot about acting from directing an episode like that?
I learned what not to say in auditions. I learned that people like shoot themselves in the foot within 30 seconds of walking into a room. I learned a lot from that side. And little things like, quite often when you're acting on camera, if you make a mistake, you'll stop. John Slattery taught me something about that, which was, don't stop, because quite often the energy that happens because you've made a mistake will mean that the next thing you're going to do, you're going to do it, you're going to discover it in a way that you haven't done it before. And the bit after you've made the mistake is going to be really good.
Yes, allow the mistake happen.
Yeah, let the mistake happen and move on, and just trust that they'll cut it out in the edit.
Now, I'm seeing you picked up on the presence of your mother in the introduction. I mean, I'm sure everybody has asked you a million times when you watch your father acting on screen, what did you learn from that XYZ? Sure. And we can come back to that in a minute. But what about your mother and her acting? Well, how much of that did you see, and how much of that?
No, I never saw her act, ever. No. I mean, she had 3 kids by the time she was 25. And, you know, my father wasn't a Mr. Mum. So, and his career was taking off. So he got a career and she got us, you know, and that was tough. You know, she loved acting. She always wanted to be an actress ever since she was a young girl. She had to give it up, but she was always passionate about it. And she was very passionate about theatre in a way that he wasn't. He always pursued the dream of the movies, and later in his life went back to the theatre famously. Yeah. But he at some point he would always talk about great performance he'd seen, but the importance of theatre to the training of an actor was something that my mother always had.
And your starting point in, I mean, I'm thinking of coming from a family where your mother had been an actress, where your father clearly, when you weren't even thinking about anything remotely like a career, your father was a star, an international star at that point. Yeah, you know, how difficult is it for you to kind of even half raise your head above the parapet thinking, I might want to do something like this? How tough was that at the time?
I think that's probably... I mean, I don't think I had that thought while I was in England. I went to college in America, yeah, at Duke University, sort of, you know, stumbled into it, into the theatre program there, and enjoyed it for the first time. Enjoyed the camaraderie of the whole experience, the extreme and the intense. You have to get on with people. You have to get to know each other. You've got to figure out. You're all trying to pull this thing off. Everyone's, you know, a bit nervous about what's going to happen. And then I enjoyed the research and the studying in a way that I wasn't ever very interested in regular classwork.
And how anonymous could you be in an American university like or college like that?
That wasn't something that people were aware of. I mean, there were a few people who knew, or who were curious. But by and large, it's a big school. There's 5,500 people there. So, you know, what's interesting is in the States, it still happens where I'm meeting people and I'm doing things like this, and they don't know. Or I was offered to play Henry Higgins in a production of My Fair Lady, and they had no idea that Rex Harrison was my stepfather.
Yeah.
So this kind of thing would happen all the time. In here or in England, they're much more aware of that connection. And that normally, if it's going to come up, it comes up right away. In the States, it doesn't come up until the very end, if it's going to come up at
all. And did your mother and father see you act in any of those college productions?
She came and saw me, and she told my father, you should go and see him, he's very good. And he said, well, you would say that, you're his mother. And you're his mother, yeah.
Yeah.
And then... He wouldn't come down and see me in anything until I graduated and I was doing Entertaining Mr. Sloan. And by then I'd also directed a movie called Darkmoor, which was a pretty pretentious film about subliminal advertising. And he came off, it was in the summer after I graduated, he came and saw the film in the afternoon and he saw the play in the evening, and he was going to tell me to be a director. But I remember still really clearly, 5 minutes into the play, I got my first laugh out of him. And his face when I saw him after the play was just so, he was just so excited, because he said, you know, you've got it, you should do this. This is, he encouraged me to pursue it at that point. And it opened up a whole new area of a relationship for us, because he could talk to me about his passion, and I wanted to know all the granular detail about it. You know.
So did you then get to know Richard Harris, the actor?
Different way, yeah. He reenacted performances he'd seen. Olivier's death scene in Coriolanus. There was another famous moment in Titus Andronicus that Olivier did at the, where he has his hand cut off in, we did down at the Stratford. Performances of Brand, Paul Schofield's
and would he do that in a way that was, you know, rather than being a pastiche or a kind of a
no, I mean, he was something that had made such a profound impact on him.
Yeah.
And you'd be discussing, it's very hard to discuss a piece if you both haven't read it. So invariably you would end up talking about the classics and the interpretations, and different actors had different, Peter O'Toole's interpretation of Hamlet versus Paul Schofield's interpretation. You know, and why that led to making choices about certain moments in the play, and they found why that was different to the other person, and it made sense to this interpretation as opposed to another. You know,
that almost sounds like a kind of an apprentice-master type of relationship.
Sure, I mean that was the only time I remember he came up. It's when he came down to see me in the play, and we were driving in the car, and he suddenly I forget, we're obviously talking about it, and he goes, suddenly went, he just stopped the conversation, he went, I'll tell you what acting is. He goes, acting is to act. And I was so being primed to be handed the sort of, you know, the secret. And I looked at him and was like, he's Miyagi'd me, you know? And what the hell does that mean? And I have to tell you, for a long time, it really confounded me. And then at a certain point in my life, I went, oh, yeah, it makes complete sense.
Yeah. Cooking is cooking. Acting
is to act, yes. I was hoping for something that would sort of make it make sense a lot quicker than it's taken.
It's taken a few years. Can I listen to a little bit of Chernobyl?
Sure.
I mean, just remind us of the character here. This is a man who has sat on secrets for a long, long time.
Well, he was part of the problem for a long time, if you like.
Yeah.
And then, you know, kept in the dark because he didn't have all the information. I mean, in this version of the story, has identified the flaw, the technical flaw as to why the RBMK reactor exploded. But the real reason is because they lied about, they kept the information away from the people who were actually running the thing. So, of course, at some point, they were going to create the exact circumstances that was going to allow it to explode.
Let's listen to the moment at which this is Legislav finally saying, no, I cannot continue with this secrecy.
No one in the room that night knew the shutdown button could act as a detonator. They didn't know it, because it was kept from them.
Comrade Legasov, you're contradicting your own testimony in Vienna.
The testimony in Vienna was a lie. I lied to the world. I'm not the only one who kept the secrets. There are many who were following orders from the KGB, from the Central Committee, and right now there are 16 reactors in the Soviet Union with the same fatal flaw. Three of them are still running, less than 20 kilometers away at Chernobyl.
Professor Legasov, if you mean to suggest the Soviet state is somehow responsible for what happened, then I must warn you, you are treading on dangerous ground.
I've already trod on dangerous ground. We're on dangerous ground right now because of our secrets and our lies. They're practically what define us. When the truth offends, we lie and lie until we can no longer remember it is even there, but it is still there. Every lie we tell incurs a debt to the truth. Sooner or later, that debt is paid.
Then when you talk about the difference between great writers and good writers, and a great writer always has their theme in mind when they're writing, and of course, that is the theme of Craig's script, which is that the idea is that we incur a debt to the truth with every lie that we tell. And the reason why the show is always relevant is that, you know, people in power are always lying. And so the when that show came out, it was in one particular period. And then not long afterwards, it sort of had a revival because of the whole COVID thing. And you know, it's constantly relevant because of the way that power reacts to the truth. It surprised all of us in the way that it had that effect around the world, because we knew it was a really good piece of work, but we didn't expect it to resonate that way globally, the way that it did. And you know, you can never know what that you can never anticipate that kind of reaction. So it was kind of a good HBO art house piece, if you like, that suddenly took off into this completely different
big
way.
Commercial, yeah. popular success. Briefly before we finish up, Jared, will you get to Limerick? Will you get to Munster at any point along the way? I'm thinking particularly of, you know, the archive of your father's material.
Yeah, sure.
Some incredible stuff there.
I think that's happening next year. I've been talking to the people at Cork, and we're starting to put together, you know, they've done this whole thing of archiving everything that's in it, and then we're coordinating with the Hunt Museum in Limerick to start trying to decide what to include in it, because there's just so much material in there.
Was the one piece of material that you found in the midst of all of that archive that kind of punched you in the stomach?
It's tough to read. It was a diary entry, if you like, where he's talking, examining himself and his how he feels about himself, his relationship to himself and to his public image, and it ends with the problem all started at Overdale, which is where he grew up. Yeah, that was a surprise. You know, there's 150 poems in there, and some of them are really touching, sad, romantic things about failed relationships and failed love affairs, and those two chief ones in his life were with my mother and then with his second wife, Anne Turkel. Mm. And they're very biographical. So there was shocks. And the other thing that I didn't know that he did, that he had this thing where he would sign off on letters that he wrote with this sort of weird, squiggly sort of face. He never did that with me. So I'd never seen that before, but he always did it with my younger brother. And so he had seen it before and he had letters from him where he did that, but yeah. I'd never seen it.
Did you feel left out?
Well, the thing about that documentary was that he had different, the reason why it was so interesting to Adrian, the director, to do was we all had very different relationships with him. And then as you discussed his relationships with other people in his life, he was never the same thing to everybody. He was always a different person, if you like, with everybody. And that's what became fascinating about it and about him. You know, and that's the reason why we were still trying to figure out who he was.
And I'll finish with a question to come back to Reawakening, since
it's getting that
Irish premiere. How nice is that for you? Because you talk about there's a pent-up Englishness in that they're not talking about stuff, sure, the husband and wife here, but that it's got its world premiere as part of the Dublin International Film Festival.
This was Virginia's first choice for where she wanted it, the premiere to be. So we're really grateful to the Dublin International Film Festival to giving us that opportunity.
Jared, lovely to have spoken to you. Thanks so much for being with us.
The Man Comes Around is a much-played song from the final album of Johnny Cash, recorded before his death in 2003. Now the man in black himself has come around again, as the voice and soul of the album he initially cut in 1993, titled Songwriter. It will be released on Friday the 28th of June. Author, producer and musician John Carter Cash co-produced the album of work solely written by his late father, Johnny Cash. It's called Songwriter, and John Carter Cash joins me now. You're very welcome, John.
Hello. It's wonderful to talk to you. I miss Ireland. I hear your voice.
Well, it's great to hear you. Now, as well as being the son of Johnny Cash and June Carter Cash, you're also an esteemed, award-winning music producer. Did you know these song demos of songs that your father had self-penned existed?
Yes, I did. I was actually on some of the original recordings. I heard my guitar on the multi-tracks, but you know, it's something that at the time my father was looking forward to making the American series, and his head really was in a different place. So when this was recorded, he wasn't necessarily thinking of it as a release. But now, looking back all these years, we have an amazing voice. His voice is so powerful on these recordings. And just the fact that it stands out as being original songs, things that he wrote himself, it makes it a very rare record. And you know, it took us a while to decide to go ahead and to put something together as a release. There is material that could be released. You know, I don't want to just release something to put it out. It's got to be something that makes sense and got to be something that I feel like is important for his legacy. He was at a great spot in his life when he recorded this music, and you certainly can hear it in his voice.
And these songs, you then arranged a group of people who you have worked with in the past and who your dad had worked with in the past when you arranged this music. So what did you do first? Did you get rid of everything except for Johnny Cash's voice and the guitar?
Well, pretty much. It was the strongest thing that was there. It was also the strong, consistent line through everything. It was my father's voice and his guitar, where we could use it. and then added a guitar backing him to sort of put the tracks together in a way that made sense. At that point, we did add drums and bass and a few other things. But I tried to keep working with David Ferguson, my co-producer. We tried to keep everything a simple production and create background music that would be fitting for, just the appropriate backdrop behind the man in black who ran everything.
We'll start with Well, All Right. Could you talk us into this? This is a very humorous song.
It's just a fun song. Dad put himself in the place of a guy who meets a lovely lady in a laundromat and falls in love. It's full of wit and humor, double entendre. It's an everyman's tale, but it's a lot of fun, and you can hear my father's character all throughout it.
I met her at the laundromat. She was washing extra hot. I said, don't you need a little help with that big load you got? She said no, but did a double take, and then she smiled and said, I might. As I rolled up my sleeves, I said to myself, well, all right, well, all right. I put it on automatic, and she sat down on the floor. She said, just keep it on medium hot. I said, I've done this before. Then I opened up the dryer and I set it on soft and light. She said, be gentle with my silk and lace. And I said, well, all right. Well, all right. Her clothes were in the basket, folded down so nice and warm. She headed for the door and I said, I will take you home. She said, I just live up the street. I said, it's a dangerous night. Take my arm and I'll carry the basket. And she said, well, all right, well, all right. The world's half full of women and the world's half full of men. And sometimes one or the other opens up to let one in. But the one I met at the laundromat that dangerous, beautiful night said, yes, I do, and yes, I will. And I said, well, all right. Well, all right.
I'll never think of the laundry the same way again. What a wonderful song.
I'm telling you. Yeah, definitely. Keep it down soft and light.
And extra, she's extra hot. I mean, it's so good.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun, you know. Dad had a way of telling a story.
Yes, and John, have you memories of him writing songs, and when would he write them?
He would go on the road and travel and perform, and he wouldn't write much when he was traveling. When he got home from a tour, he sometimes would go to his farm or he would go to his cabin in the woods. And he would write then. He would write usually when he was alone. He hardly ever wrote with other people. It was fun for him. It was some sort of almost therapy for him at times. It's his way of expressing himself. But it was just him enjoying life and letting the music come out from having lived life.
Those songs, I mean, his voice is so crystal clear in that. I mean, the recordings, as you say, he was in a very good place. His voice is sounding as when it was at its peak.
Yes, definitely so. Yeah, it was a peak for him. And this is right before, you know, a real renaissance in his life when he was about to record some records that were going to win Grammys and get high acclaim. And he was stepping into a new part of his career. And this is right at the cusp of that. It's very interesting. In February of 1993, he performed on stage in Dublin, and U2 got up and sang with Dad. Everybody in the band but Edge got up and were on stage with Dad. I was there myself when I was playing in the group with him in 1993, and that's something I'll never forget. The next day after that, Bono wrote the song "The Wanderer," and Dad put down his vocal for the track. And later on that month, he met Rick Rubin. And then not long after that, he recorded all this music.
And you also had the joy, I'm sure, as being an associate producer on your father's albums.
Yes, ma'am. Yep, I worked with Dad in the studio almost every session from American 3 until the last two albums that came out after he passed away, the posthumous releases that were part of the American series.
And, I mean, you learned to music at your father and mother's and grandparents' knees. So that idea of working together on musical projects wasn't strange for you, was it? Or was it a bit daunting being in the studio with him?
No, not really at all. I mean, it's a course in life, you know. But, I mean, my father was always, it was all about family to him. And it had to be something that he felt comfortable with. But he loved so many people that he worked with in the studio. But I'm so grateful I had the chance to work with him as a producer, as a co-producer, as an associate producer, or just to spend the time with him. And it's sort of, you know, the early part of my career when I was developing my talents. My dad always said to my mother also, follow your love. Whatever it is your bliss is, whatever your joy is in life, follow that. And that's really, when you're doing that, it's free. It's good. It's an easier path than some competition or trying to be something that I'm not.
Even though you were on the road and you had all the glamour of being on the road with Johnny Cash and with June Carter Cash, you also had, they both were people who loved nature and the cabin you spoke about. You spent a lot of time in the woods hunting and doing quite normal things with your folks.
Yes, I spent a lot of time, you know, in the outdoors fishing with my father. You know, and traveling was an adventure to them. We were all over Ireland when I was young, you know, in a small tour bus. I remember being there. And of course, my father penned a beautiful song about Ireland, 40 Shades of Green. And he would sing that for the folks on stage there from when I could remember. And every person in the whole audience knew every word. And so we felt very accepted there. But my parents, they were loving people and they always had a great time, and they were my best friends really growing up.
And talking about 40 Shades of Green, I know it's that your father wrote it, but so many people would argue almost with him that he didn't write it because it seemed so authentically Irish.
Yeah, he had some fella tell him one time that his mother sang it to him when he was a boy, and Dad said, well, what year would that have been? And the fella said, 1963. And my dad said, well, I wrote it in 1958. So, he would, you know, because it's so cherished by the Irish people, gratefully.
Well, John Carter Cash, thank you so much for talking to us.
And Arena Olympiad will be back at 9 p.m. tomorrow evening.